Hello and welcome to this episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales. For those of you who've never listened before, first we'll start with a story, then some talking about the folklore and history of the food in the story, some analysis of the story, and then there'll be a recipe. Today our story is The Laird with the Heart of Gold, adapted from the tale found in Thistle and Thyme by Saoirse Nic Liodas, which is told to her by a storyteller from just north of Inverness in Scotland and collected into the book. So, gentle listener, are you listening comfortably? Then I'll begin. There once was a young Scottish laird that folks all said had a heart of gold. That was because he could not bear the sight of anyone in trouble without trying to do something to help them. He was that good-natured and open-handed, his like would be hard to find, especially now. He was a young lad when his mother died, and his father, the old laird, never got over her death. He sent the laddie to live with a connection of the family in the North Country, for the son took after his mother so much, the old laird couldn't look upon his face without sorrow. Well, the lad grew up, and by, the old laird died. So they sent for the young laird to come back and take over the estates. When he did, he was sorry he'd come, for the old laird had let everything go to rack and ruin while he shut himself up in his study and read his books and broke his heart over and over again over losing his wife. When the notary read out the list of what was coming to the young laird, it sounded grand enough. There was a lot of land and a village with a kirk and some farms here and there and a grand park with deer in it, and of course there was the castle. But when the lad rode about looking at what his father had left him, there was another side to the story. The land was there, right enough, but most of it had gone wild. Only two or three of the farms were being kept up properly. The rest weren't worth the name farm. Most of the houses in the village were tumbling down, and as for the kirk, it looked noble enough on the outside, but inside, it was more fit to be used for a barn than it was to worship in it. It had a huge hole in the roof. The deer in the park were the only things the lad took any comfort in, for they were sleek and friendly, and nothing else he'd seen that day, human or not, had been either one or the other. And when he got back to the castle and gave it a good look over, he saw it was as bad as all the rest. The only good thing about it was the old family servants who loved him and tried to make him comfortable. But it wasn't much wonder he wished he'd stayed away. Well, half a dozen years went by, and things were no worse. For they couldn't be, but certainly they were little better. Each quarter day when rents were due, it was always the same. Some of the tenants were honest, but couldn't pay, because they had ill luck, and some of them who were able to pay were dishonest, and put on just a look and said they didn't have any money either. Only the two or three good farmers paid up regularly and in full, so what the laird collected was barely more than enough to keep bannocks and cheese on the table. But the laird was so good-hearted he believed all of them, all of their tales, and he felt sorry for them. He might have had more for himself if he'd turned the servants off, but they were all getting on in years, and he was afraid they'd never find a new place. Besides, he loved them, and they loved him, and although about all they got out of it was a roof over their heads and as good to eat as he's got, which wasn't that much, there was quite a lot of them, so the young laird worried himself a good bit about how he'd take care of them all. One winter's quarter day, the laird came back in the gloaming from gathering rents all day, which is something he had to do himself, for if he waited for them to be brought to him, he'd have had a long, long wait. All he got was excuses and promises and barely enough money to tide him over until the next quarter day. He was so disheartened he didn't know what to do. He'd left his horse at home because he didn't like to take the poor beast out all day in the bad weather, so he plodded along on foot in the dusk with his head down against the snow and the wind. There was a fork in the road where half of it went down the mill beyond and the other half went up the hill to the castle. There at the place where the roads parted, he saw what he took to be, well, a heap of children's toys by the roadside with lots of little dolls beside them. He couldn't see that well in the dark with the dark closing in and the snow in his face, and when he got up to them he gave them, well, like another look, and he saw that pile wasn't toys at all. Nor were the other things dolls, for they were all as alive and breathing as himself. It was a whole lot of brownies, and the heap of things were their little sticks of furniture. "Well," said the laird, "what is it you're doing here out in the wind and the snow and the cold, and why aren't you nice and warm in someone's home?" Then one of the brownies stepped out from the rest. "I'm Lachy Tosh," said he, "and this is my wife, and our seven sons, and their wives, with each their seven sons, and their sons' wives, and their children and all. I'm head of our sept of our clan, and we're flitting." The laddie bent down and politely took the hand the wee man offered him. "Where are you flitting to?" he asked. "We're flitting from the mill," Lachy Tosh told him, "and it's bitter hard we should be made to. The Toshes have always lived at the mill since time began. My mother and his father and his father and his father's father and all our fathers before them have been mill brownies. But the miller's wife died, and now he's bought a new wife from the town, and she'll have nothing to do with the brownies." "She says there are no brownies," said one of the clan. "She says we're big, great brown rats," shrieked another. Then they all began shouting at one at the same time. "She says we steal the flour. She says we eat holes in the cheese. She says we take eggs from the nests, that we skim cream from the milk. And she brought in a great big cat to frighten our children, and two fierce dogs to chase us away from the corn." "Shh," shouted Lachy Tosh and held up a hand. At once the babble stopped. "So that is why we're flitting," said the brownie. "Ah, I see that well," said the laird. "But where will you be going now?" "Well," said Lachy Tosh, "that's what we're doing here. We've stopped to talk it over, but they've all been arguing for an hour gone, and we haven't even picked a place." The laird was really troubled by the brownie's problems. "The castle's got litter to offer you," he said, "but you'd be warm and dry there anyway. The servants are an old-fashioned sort, and I don't doubt you'd be welcome. The cook does have a cat, but she's one of those sort of very round, comfortable, purring sort of beasties, and she doesn't even trouble the mice, if I'm honest. And as for, well, my two dogs, they'd be no trouble to you, for to be honest, they're so friendly. They run around the garden with the hares and the rabbits, and they don't do them any harm at all. Do you think you'd like to come to me at the castle?" "Ah, yeah, we would," said Lachy Tosh, and the laird thought he'd give them a word of warning. "You'll find we haven't got much to do with, but what we have got we'll gladly share. There'll be porridge and milk and bannock and some cheese too. Whatever there is, you're welcome to it." "Say no more," said Lachy Tosh. "Come on." The brownie men picked up their furniture, and the brownie women took up their bundles and some of their smaller children, and up they all trooped up after the laird to the castle. The housekeeper met them in the hall, for she'd been keeping an eye out for the laird. What with the dark coming on and him out being so late, she was so troubled. But when he opened the door and led the brownie folk in, she stood, well, dumbstruck. She couldn't say anything in her tracks. "Mistress MacIver," said the laird to her, "I've brought you the brownies of the mill. They've been turned out by the miller's new town-bred wife, and they've got no place to shelter themselves in." At that point, the housekeeper found her voice. "Oh, the poor wee thing," she cried. "Come in, come in. Come into the fire and give yourselves a warm." "Well, you've got room for us all?" asked Lachy Tosh. "We're little, but there's an awful lot of us." "Is it room?" he asked, in light of the housekeeper. "In this great place, with just a few of us rattling about in it? Oh, you were doing us a favour, helping to fill it up so it doesn't feel so empty." Lachy Tosh was so well pleased with that, he said gratefully, and in no time at all, the brownies were settled into the castle as if they'd always been there. And, as predicted, the cat and the dogs, well, they made no trouble at all. Indeed, the cat seemed to think the brownie children were little kittens of a sort, for she cuddled them and she washed their faces and hands and purred them to sleep before the fire. And as for the laird's dogs, well, they acted as if their lives have never been complete until the brownies arrived. The servants liked the brownies' cheerful chatter and their lovely pleasant faces, and on the whole it was agreed the castle was a better place since the brownies came. Candles burned brighter, the fires blazed higher and took less fuel to do it, the hens laid more eggs and took less more to feed them. The meal sack seemed to grow heavier instead of lighter each day, and there was more cream to the milk that the cows gave, and there seemed to be more food for the table instead of less, even though there was all those extra mouths to feed. But everyone was contented. Well, no, not everyone. You see, Lachy Tosh, he'd go out every morning and be gone. He'd be gone for a long time. When he came back, the frown on his brow reached down to his rosy cheeks and the corners of his mouth drooped down further each day. And as for the laird, his nice young face grew longer and sadder by the day. When the brownies had been in the castle a little above a month, the laird sat down in his study one day over his account books. The study was a cheerful place now, for the brownie woman had everything as neat as a pin, and a big fire burned in the fireplace. But the laird's face was far from cheerful, because he was trying to balance his accounts, and with so much paid out and so little paid in, he couldn't do it, no matter what he did. Lucky Tosh came in and climbed up into a chair facing the lad, and the lad laid his pen down, for he saw the brownie had come to talk to him. "Lad," said the brownie, "I've something to say that I don't think you're going to like." "Oh, Lucky," said the lad, "there's nothing you could say that I'd take amiss. Well, it's my way to speak plain. So, speak plain, I will." "So, Lucky, I don't like the way things are going on here. This is what I feared," said the lad, and now you'll be wanting to go away, no doubt. Well, the castle's a poor place, and I can't say I blame you, but we've just loved having you here, and we'll be so sorry to see you go." "Oh, no," said the brownie indignantly. "You've read my meaning wrong. We're all as snug here as we could ever hope to be. We're castle brownies now, and we're staying that way. We're settled here to stay." "I'm relieved to hear it," said the lad. "It's things outside the castle that are a problem," said Lucky earnestly. "Wilful waste makes woeful want. That's where the trouble lies, lad." "I know it," said the lad. "I know it well." "And another thing," said Lucky, "butter and brawn in the cottage and bannocks and cheese in the castle isn't right, and it never will be." "But how can the cottagers have butter and meat when they can't even pay their rents? There aren't many of them who can find things for money like that." "More than you know," said Lucky. "But how are they going to come by the money? They haven't got the money to make ends meet." "They get the money by not paying their rent," said Lucky. "That's how." The lad looked at Lucky, and Lucky looked right back at him. "Look, I've been going round and about," said Lucky. "A wee person like me sees more than sees him. I know who's got money laid by that hasn't paid their rent since the old lad's time, and the laziness and thriftlessness and shiftlessness I've seen makes my blood boil with rage. I'm going to say no more about it." "No doubt you're right, Lucky," said the lad, "but what am I to do? A thought to my head swims and I can't find a way to set things right." "It's your heart of gold," said Lucky gently. "You trust everyone and you believe every tale they tell you. You're too good to people, lad. What you need is a factor." "I'd have one if I could pay him," said the lad. "Someone who knows how to go about managing an estate would do much better than me. And well, I know it. But how could I ever pay a factor?" "How about me?" said Lucky. "I'll take it on if you like." The lad sat up in his chair and he stared at the brownie. "You, Lucky," he exclaimed. "Why not me?" said Lucky. "Me and the help I get from my sons and my sons' sons and the rest. It'd take a sharp rascal to be getting the better of all of us, wouldn't it?" The lad looked troubled. "I wouldn't want you to be hard on people whose luck has been lacking," he said, doubtfully. "Those that deserve good will get it," said Lucky firmly, "and those that don't, won't. And you need not fear I'll be mistaking the one for the other either. I don't know. I might even find ways of mending the luck of those who need it," said Lucky. That brought the lad over as Lucky knew it would. "Well," said the lad, "you might have a try at it, Lucky, if you like. Give me the books then," Lucky ordered, "and go to bed and leave me to get on with it." The lad gratefully gave the brownie his books and off he went to bed. Strangely, he slept soundly that night. It was the first time he'd done so since he came back to the castle. The brownie, on the other hand, got no sleep at all, for he sat up all night over the books. And what he learned about the way the tenants paid or didn't pay made him pound the pages with his little fist and grin with rage. People found things weren't the same as they used to be when Lucky Tosh took over. The letters were the start of it. They began to fall like big flakes of snow, thick and fast. Those that got them, well, they didn't like them much. They were all written in very tiny writing, and they were short, and they were plain spoken, and all of them told folks what they hadn't done, and to do it at once, and no excuses were accepted. "Your fence wants mending, tend to it," said one letter. Another one read, "Give your shed a wash of white, your cow's ashamed to live in it." "You've got £20 of silver in the box under your bed, your own," to the lad. "See that he gets it," another letter said, and still another, "If you'd rather eat well than pay your rent, go and do it somewhere else." There were more like that, and all of them were unpleasant sort, like the ones you've heard about. All were signed Lucky Tosh, Factor. Folks went round asking each other, "Who is this Lucky Tosh?" Not a soul could answer that, but it was uncanny the way he knew all their secrets anyone had. He knew everything, and he let folks know he knew, and what he knew. The lazy ones, the thriftless ones, the dishonest ones had no peace at all, for whoever he was or wherever he came from was sure he had a terrible rough tongue in his letters. But no one ever caught the sight of him. It was no use to rush to the castle and demand he came forth. All they saw was the housekeeper, who gave them the sort of welcome that sent them hurrying back home and wishing they hadn't come. And it was no use taking their troubles to the lad, for though he listened politely, all he said at the end was, "You'll have to take it up with the factor." So they all learned it saved them trouble to do what they were told and no fuss about it. And for those who were too lazy to mend their ways, they were told to go. And they did, and it was a good riddance. The good times were over, for the lady had got him a factor. It was wonderful then, the way things got better. Farms looked like farms, and if farmers actually were farming them. The church roof was mended, and so were the houses along the village street. It was a wonder to see how things picked up for those whose luck wanted mending. Someone who had health that had lacked it for a year. Another one had heard of a place in town that needed a young fellow and went and got took on. The oldest daughter of a widow had chance to go into service where she was happy and well paid. So both of them were able to send money to help out at home. Little by little, the ill luck went away, and none of the folks on the Laird's estate remembered it any more. When the next quarter day came round, it was a treat to see folks coming up to the castle to pay what they owed. When it was over, Lackey Tosh came out of the cupboard where he'd been hiding to keep an eye on them all and make sure they all paid up as they should. He came out rubbing his wee hands together in glee. "Well," he said, "the accounts is balanced now with some over to spare. So now we'd better take heed of you, lad." "It's nothing I need," he said. "It's yourself that should have something, Lackey, for all the toil and trouble that's been yours." "Oh, you and your heart of gold," said Lackey. "With all the living you off now for me than the least child of my son's son's sons, let us have no more foolish talk." And then the brownie added, "There's two things you need, and the first one's clothes. You're so threadbare, I'm ashamed to see you walking about, unless the clothes on your back leave you entirely. So off you go to town and have the tailor make you a suit of clothes, and when you come back, I'll tell you what it is, the other thing that you need." So the lad went off to town, since Lackey said he had to, and in a week's time he came back dressed in his new clothes, and there wasn't a lad to match him in looks in all of Scotland. Lackey looked over him before and behind and up and down. "You'll do," said Lackey, "and now for the second thing you need, and that's a wife." "A wife?" said the lad. He sounded scared, but you could tell he was a bit pleased at the idea too. "But where will I find one?" "Look about you till you do," Lackey told him. "I've never had much to do with lassies. What would I be saying to her?" asked the lad. "Well, you could ask her what she thinks of brownies in the house," said Lackey. "Ah, I could do that," said the lad. "But look now, Lackey, how will I know she's the right one?" "Don't trouble yourself about that. You'll know right enough when the time comes," Lackey said, "and there'll be no way to mistake her." So the lad rode away to the north, where he had a cousin living. He met a likely lass there, and when he had a chance to get her alone, he asked, "What do you think about brownies?" She looked at him, surprised, and said, "Brownies? I don't think of them at all, because I don't believe in them." Well, she wasn't the one he wanted, so he went away from there, and he rode south and further south, and then he met the one most wonderful girl he'd ever seen, just back from school in Edinburgh. She was not only handsome, but terribly well educated. So after they got better acquainted, he asked her, "What would your opinion be of brownies in the house?" "My good man," she said, "the idea of the existence of brownies is the attempt of the common people to explain the disappearance of the ancient Picts." The lad got away from there in a hurry. No, that one would never do at all. He had another cousin, living in the east. So he rode over there. He liked the looks of the woman he found in his cousin's house, for she was a bonny wee thing, not much bigger than a brownie herself. He soon got friendly with her, and one evening asked her, "What would you be thinking of a brownie in the house?" At that she threw up her hands and screamed. "Oh!" She said, "Couldn't bear the thought of it, the horrid little things, and in the house, oh no!" Well, the lad, he didn't want that one, no mistake about it. And there was no place to ride to except the west, but he didn't do any better there. For when he asked the question of the woman he found there, she said, "I've never given it a thought, but fair certain I wouldn't like them at all." So there he was, with nothing to do but ride home and tell Lackey he couldn't find the right lass, north, south, east or west. As he was riding home, he came by the mill Brownies had flitted from. And there, on a bench by the door of the mill, sat a beautiful young woman with her hands in her lap. It was the miller's daughter, and she was feeling sad, and she and the wife her father had brought from town didn't get on well, having different ideas about almost everything. And when the laird saw her, oh, his heart gave such a jump of joy. So he stopped his horse, and he gave her a good day, and she looked up at him, and he looked down at her, and he asked her, "What do you think of brownies in the house?" She'd been crying, and there were tears in her eyes, but she smiled through the tears, and she said, "Oh, the dear wee things. There was always brownies at the mill when my mother was alive." So he took her up on his horse with him, and off he rode to the castle to tell Lackey he'd found the lass he wanted for his wife. Lackey looked at her and looked at the laird and smiled all over his face. "You went too far afield, my lad," he said. "I could have told you so. She's the one I was thinking of, and I told you to look about. I just didn't think you'd look so far." So the laird married the miller's daughter, And it was a great big wedding. All the brownies from Lackey to the least one came to it too. For the lad and the miller's daughter said there'd be no wedding unless the brownies were there. It was strange that none of the other guests noticed them, but it must have been because they were enjoying themselves too much to pay any heed to the wee folks. And ever after, all went well. And why should anything go wrong with a castle full of brownies and Lackey Tosh for the factor? And a lass who loved the brownies, and a lad with a heart of gold. And that, gentle listener, is the end of my tale, and I hope it pleased you, for it had no other purpose. So tell me, what did you think of the tale? It's a little bit different to our normal thing, but the book from which this tale is adapted from suggests this was based on a member of the Grant clan. So it isn't a traditional tale, but it's a newer folk tale, which uses very traditional folklore elements and themes, and it seems to be set in the 18th, 19th century. I found it fascinating to see the impact on traditional folkloric creatures like the brownies. As education became more prevalent, people started to disbelieve in them and no longer wanted them in their homes. Also, it was interesting for the hero of the tale to be a landlord, not a person who starts out as a victim of a grasping landlord. I did also feel a little bit for the tenants. After years of being taken advantage of, it must have seemed almost irresistible to seize the opportunity to have the upper hand, especially when you consider how hard it would be subsistence farming in the north of Scotland. As we don't know the date of the origin of this tale, we don't know if it coincided with the tragedy of the Highland Clearances, where many forced evictions took place, sometimes because landlords were in a financially precarious position themselves. It could be thought that the brownies were trying to enforce the old world order, but I like to think they're just helping someone who was at a disadvantage, because he was essentially kind and well-meaning and had taken them in and shared what little he had. Helping the kind but slightly clueless hero is definitely a traditional role for one of the friendlier fair folk. You'll have to let me know your opinions. I've made a big assumption here that you know all about brownies and their connection with food and tales, so maybe I could just give you a brief overview for those of you who are thinking, what exactly are brownies? Except for the chocolate treat, we all know what that is, as this tale doesn't give much away about their backstory. Brownies or pookas are the types of fairies that bring good fortune to your home and family and either do household chores on your behalf or farm chores or improve the skill of the person doing the chores so the house always looks clean and well kept, bread always rises, food never spoils, crops always grow and harvests are always big. Any business enterprises outside the home are also blessed with success. These brownies are thanked by gifts of food by the householders, which are never brought to their attention, just left in a certain place as an explicit offer of reward would make the brownie leave. These gifts were often cream, a slice of good bread or cake, sometimes spread with honey. According to William Henderson in Folklore of the Northern Counties, children were sometimes told they had a particularly nice treat. There's a piece would please a brownie. Taking away a brownie's food could cause it to become spiteful and mischievous, causing food to spoil, crops to fail, animals to fall ill, and increasing bad luck to the property and the family. Those turned brownies were known as boggarts. The brownies in this story are unusual because they make their presence known. Usually they're quite secretive creatures, and only the results of their handiwork are ever seen, not the creatures themselves. The only other story I know of where they're that much present is an English tale known as Food, Fire and Company, which I've told on this podcast as part of a collection of cosy stories for the cold, dark parts of the year, although actually it's set in summer. So it's probably time to move on to our selection of food to consider from the story. We could have had brawn. I literally didn't fancy it. I must admit I haven't tried it. I'm probably being hypocritical though. If it was presented to me as a delicious tureen, I'd probably dive in before you could say toast. Anyway, I imagine that wouldn't be a topic for everyone. Well, most people actually. So we'll concentrate on the slightly more appealing Scottish cheese and bannocks. They have a rich history and an interesting place in folklore, and thankfully no piggies will have to be sacrificed in the interest of this podcast. I've specified Scottish cheese because it has a different history to English cheese, for various reasons that incorporate geography, less cows, and the Roman lack of ambition, inability to conquer the Scots, pick your preferred version, that had them stopping at Hadrian's Wall. This had a significant impact on the types of cheese made, because a lot of the techniques used in England for making hard cheeses came from the Romans. So early cheeses in Scotland were of the acidic soft type, like Crowdie, a soft fresh cheese made with skim milk, and Cabbock, a soft fresh cheese made from cream rolled in oats. In addition, these could be made from sheep and goat's milk if cow's milk was in short supply. The majority of hard cheese, which was made outside of Ayrshire, was very hard and dry, as it was made from skim milk with the cream skimmed off for butter making. Ayrshire had more cows and fertile grazing land, and it's where Dunlop was invented in the 1700s. Dunlop is more of a young cheddar type cheese, but in the Highlands where Allard is from, just outside Inverness, he and his servants would very likely have been eating that very hard skimmed milk cheese, or crowdy, as Cabbock was a cheese for the wealthy, it used to be made with cream. Maybe the lad could afford it when his fortunes changed. Crowdy is a very old cheese, made by most families that had a cow. It was made by taking raw skim milk and leaving it for 24 hours to sour. As it soured, the curds naturally separated, leaving behind the whey. The curds were then pressed and drained to make a soft, spreadable cheese. You can still make it now, using pasteurised milk and heating and adding a souring agent. Cabbock, on the other hand, has a completely different origin story, almost a folk tale in its own right, or perhaps a legend. The story starts in the 15th century with Marietta the Eel, the old daughter of the chieftain MacDonald of the Isles. It was thought that from the age of 12 she was in danger of being kidnapped by the Campbell clan and forcibly married to one of their own so they could steal her estates. In order to remove her from danger, she was smuggled to Ireland for her safety. It was there that she learned the secret of full cream cheese making, and the recipe was developed. The recipe was said to pass through an unbroken female line from mother to daughter, all the way from Marietta to the current cheesemaker, Susanna Stone, in Tain, Scotland. Susanna reinstated the making of this cheese in 1961 using the still-secret recipe. It's also said that running the oats in cheese and oats began when a long-ago herder stored his cheese in a box previously made for oatcakes and liked the taste so much that Cabbock was then always made that way. Another less romantic version is that Susanna added the oats herself to improve the taste and texture. I'll leave it up to you. I don't think that the hard Scottish cheese is without any folklore of its own, though. Inverness actually had its own cheese riot in 1666, close to the castle, after a man dropped a piece of cheese into the river and refused to pay for the damages. The argument turned into a full-scale riot. The town guard was summoned, muskets were raised, and shots were fired. 2 people were killed and 10 people were injured. This was not the only outcome, sad as it was. It turned out that the 2 killed belonged to the MacDonald clan, the selfsame clan whose daughter first made Cabbock, and they wanted compensation of 66,000 Scottish pounds, tax exemption, any Invernessian to submit to a MacDonald, amongst many other demands. In the end, Inverness only had to pay 4,800 Scottish pounds, which is a lot of money even so. The saddest thing in my mind is that no one seems to be able to ascertain whether the original cheesemonger was paid for their cheese. One more last piece of Scottish cheese folklore. There was once a cheese used for divining the future, known as, I'm sorry about my pronunciation, Lomachen, or Little Mouldy One. The cheese had to be made on one of the 4 old festivals of the Gaelic year, Beltane, Lunasa, Imbolc, or Samhain, from the milk of cows that have grazed on Mothan or Bog Violet. It had to be made on one of those nights for it to be powerful. But the milk of these cows was also said to protect the drinker from any future supernatural mischief, regardless of the cheese. If the child drank the milk, they would be protected from fairy abduction in particular. So, we turn to our other foodstuff, the famous Scottish bannock, which is defined by the Oxford English Dictionary as the name in Scotland and north of England of a form in which homemade bread is made, usually unleavened, of large size, round or oval form, and flattish, without being as thin as a scone or oatcake. In Scotland, bannocks are usually made of barley or piecemeal, but maybe of wheat and flour. The word comes from the Gaelic bannock, which also means morsel or little cake, depending on where you look. The old English version of the word is bannock, and it's suggested that this all came from the root Latin word panicium, meaning anything baked. There is written evidence of the old English version in 1000 CE, so it suggests this is a very old bread indeed. The Scottish version was baked on a bannock stone over the fire, and then portioned into slices, like a cake. You can still get this, often served with thick seafood soups like Cullen Skink. It often uses oatmeal and sometimes baking soda to give it a lift, but it's still a substantial filling bread today. Appears in many a folk tale, with mothers asking their youngest sons if they'll take the whole bannock with her curse or half with her blessing. There's more to that, as I think I've mentioned before, as by leaving the youngest sons, removing the main source of only a few sources of income available to his mother. If he takes the whole bannock, he's leaving her with nothing. By taking half, he's recognising she'll need some form of sustenance, and he isn't only thinking of himself. The first bannock in a tale I always think of is the one which contains an iron bar given to Cuchulainn by Una in The Legend of Knockmany, which breaks the giant's teeth. It was one of my favourite tales as a child, and I even made an episode of it in 2020, should you fancy a listen. I talk about a lot about soda bread in that episode, but it was much more likely to have been this type of unleavened bread. Soda bread wasn't invented, as I mentioned in the episode, till early in the 20th century, or late 19th at least. There are also links to recipes for the bannock type bread in the further reading for that episode. There is also a possible link to bannocks being used as a way of choosing a sacrificial victim in Druidic sacrifice. I must admit, I don't know much about the current Druidic practice, so if you're interested in that, there are some good books, including A Taster in the Book of English Magic by Philip Cargum and Richard Haygate. But I'm certain any sacrifices that are conducted these days are not of the human kind. However, there is some evidence to suggest that in pre-Roman Britain and other Northern European communities, human sacrifice did take place. It was believed that one of the ways to choose a sacrifice was via a burned piece of bannock. The person who received the burned piece would become the sacrifice. Lindoman, or Lindo II, is the connection between Druidic sacrifice and bannocks. He's a body that was found in the Lindo Moss peat bog near the town of Wilmslow, and his death is placed roughly between 2 BCE and 119 CE. The story of how he and an earlier skull from a similar period were found, and how they were complicated by a much more modern 20th century murder mystery, is fascinating. You can find a link in further reading at the bottom of this page, or at least in the show notes, should you wish to know more. Anyway, back to our bannock and Druidic ritual link. Lindo Man's stomach contents were analysed and were found to contain emmer, spelt wheat and barley, which were probably ingested in the form of unleavened bread, sphagnum leaves and also viscum album, or by its common name, mistletoe. There is evidence to suggest some of the grains in Lindo Man's stomach were burned, and the presence of mistletoe, a hallucinogenic, often used in early Druidic rituals, does suggest the possibility a ritual, especially as it was where he was found, could have been in the water originally, a liminal space for sacrifice. Although there is no definite evidence that this is what actually happened to Lindo Man, as different archaeologists have different theories, and it's difficult to prove one over the other. One of the other theories suggests a contemporary murder or robbery murder due to the nature of the body's injuries. I'll leave you to investigate further, should you wish to, and come to your own conclusions. I think the only thing left now is the recipe, which is a fresh drained cheese. You can make it at home. It's similar to crowdie, or you can use it to make things like paneer or farmer's cheese. It's a very similar recipe. You'll find that by following the link in the show notes or going to the blog page to see the actual instructions. But if you've got chance in a cool kitchen, I'd recommend it. And with that, we come to the end of this episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any questions, you want to challenge anything I've said, or you simply want to know more about the story, you can contact me via most of the social media channels or via the contact form on my website, www.hestiaskitchen.co.uk. I'll be taking my traditional break in August for my birthday, and also because I want to put together something really special for the podcast's third birthday in September. So I hope you'll look out for that in your subscriber feed. And that definitely brings us to the end of this episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales.